From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet one of the rhythm and blues stars of the 50s and 60s, Etta James. She was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame last year. Now she has a new album paying tribute to one of her early influences, Billie Holiday. Also today, the lead singer behind one of the great Motown groups, Martha Reeves. Martha and the Vandellas, now classic recordings, include Dancing in the Streets, Come and Get These Memories, and Nowhere to Run. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Cuba is calling for direct negotiations with the United States. The Cuban ambassador to the UN says his country is willing to talk about the current wave of refugees coming to the United States, but any talks would have to be comprehensive and include other topics. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
Ambassador Ramirez charged that current U.S. policy towards Cuba is to blame for the current wave of illegal immigrants fleeing to the U.S. He said that while in the past Cuba had succeeded in controlling immigration, he said his country is tired of being the custodian of U.S. shores. During a news conference, he linked the current exodus to the U.S. economic embargo imposed on Cuba more than 30 years ago and suggested that the refugee issue couldn't be resolved without lifting the embargo. He also charged that the Clinton administration is attempting to overthrow the Castro regime. He warned that efforts to economically choke his country would lead to a bloodbath that would force millions to flee to the U.S. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
A judge has refused to reinstate Benjamin Chavis as executive director of the NAACP. Judge Herbert Dixon says Chavis must wait for another judge to resolve his lawsuit seeking damages from his firing. The former leader will have to wait for the hearing September 2nd, but both Chavis and the civil rights group say they hope to discuss an out-of-court settlement before then. Chavis was terminated by the group's board of directors over the weekend for a nearly $3 million deficit. Board members also disapproved of his use of NAACP money to settle a sexual harassment lawsuit. Liberal members of the Senate are sounding a little blue about the prospects of health care reform this year. UPI's Pi Chamberlain prepared this report.
After House Speaker Foley said he could accept a bare-bones health reform bill, Senate liberals sounded like they were ready to throw in the towel. Democrat Mikulski of Maryland.
The opportunity for passing health insurance reform is shrinking by the moment. That our passion and desire to be able to see health insurance reform become a reality is now fading.
The liberals said the so-called mainstream compromise is not acceptable. They spoke of acting next year rather than this. Their opposition to the mainstream plan was backed by powerful lobbies representing the elderly and people with disabilities. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
Russian authorities have detained two men for stealing nuclear material. The Russian Counterintelligence Service says the two unemployed men were arrested on Sunday after they were found carrying 21 pounds of stolen uranium. It's the latest in a series of thefts of nuclear material from Russian plants and research facilities. Russian authorities admit their security could be tighter, but they deny any weapons-grade material has been taken. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up more than 53 points at 3,829. Trading is very heavy. In over-the-counter trading, the NASDAQ is up 3. This is NPR. The former education minister and drug czar for Presidents Reagan and Bush has decided not to run for president himself in 1996. William Bennett has been courted by religious conservative leaders to enter what could be a crowded Republican field for the presidential nomination in 2 years. But Bennett says that over his summer vacation, he's decided that his current family and professional circumstances have led him to decide this isn't the best time to seek the presidency. The Senate has approved a measure that revamps the way government makes purchasing decisions. The compromise legislation incorporates many of the changes Vice President Al Gore proposed as part of his campaign to reinvent government. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The bill changes the way the government buys $200 billion worth of planes, pencils, and other goods annually. The measure would erase scores of regulations and paperwork requirements to encourage agencies to buy commercially available items rather than custom-made ones. would also encourage the government to rely more on computers to buy goods faster and less expensively. The biggest changes would take place at the Defense Department, which accounts for 3/4 of the government's purchasing. Legislation's goal is to ease the burden created by a torrent of regulations the government adopted in the 1980s after the scandals over Pentagon purchases of $640 toilet seats and other expensive items. Some companies have refused to do business with the government because of its complicated procedures. The measure would make paperwork less cumbersome for purchases costing less than $100,000, while contracts worth less than $2,500 would have even fewer regulations. The measure now moves on to the House. If approved, it is expected to be signed by President Clinton this fall. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
Officials of the United Nations are voicing concern over the Pope's planned trip to Sarajevo. It's set for September 8th. There's a ceasefire in the Bosnian capital, but snipers have wounded and killed people in the city and often target planes that land at the airport. The whole city is still within range of Serbian artillery. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Etta James, is a rhythm and blues veteran. She got her start at the age of 15 when she was discovered by Johnny Otis and began performing with his traveling R&B review. By age 17, she had her first hit, Roll With Me Henry, an answer song to Hank Ballard's Work With Me Annie. After establishing herself as a rhythm and blues star in the late 50s and early 60s, her career was eclipsed by changes in pop music. But last year she was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Etta James' new album, Mystery Lady, pays tribute to the great jazz singer Billie Holiday. James performs songs recorded by Holiday, like this one, The Very Thought of You.
The very thought of you, and I forget to do. The little ordinary things that everyone ought to do. I'm living in a kind of daydream. I'm happy as a queen, but foolish though it may seem to me, that's everything.
Etta James, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell me the story of why you wanted to record a Billie Holiday record.
Well, I thought that since I grew up in, I did my teenage years in San Francisco, and my mother was such a Billie Holiday and jazz fan, mostly Billie Holiday. And I kind of, all along, I said, what, jazz? You know, so to me, as a young kid, that was like, it was too disciplined, it was too confining, at least that's the way I thought. And I thought you had to be really, really cool and had to be bourgeois, you know, to do that. And I didn't want to do that. I mean, I was a sloppy kid with tattoos all over. I wanted to be just wild. I really think that I had to mature. I got to the point where I'm 56 years old. I think it took me maturing.
Now, let me ask you this. You grew up in a foster home. I think when your mother had you, she was 14 years old.
Right. She was a kid. And, you know, I had feelings about all that kind of stuff for years, and I went to therapy and all about it. But then as I got older, I realized that she really did the best for me. She put me in a lovely home. The people were, you know, lovely to me. They never said that they were my real parents. I mean, I always knew I had this good-looking, you know, high-stepping mom, and she was like only 14 years older than me. And so she did the best for me, because if she had tried to take me with her, she was just a child, what would she have done with me? Would I have been singing today? Would I have been anything, you know?
What was your foster family like?
They were lovely. They were older people, and they had property, and they lived in the east side, lower east side of Los Angeles. And my grandmother was a church lady, and they believed in, they gave me singing lessons at 5. And
When you were singing in the church choir, did your grandmother or anyone else in the family get upset if on your own time you sang blues or any kind of secular music?
No, because when as long as my grandmother lived until I was, my grandmother died when I was 12. So I sang gospel music from 5 until 12. And so my grandmother, she wasn't one of those kind of people because I was already the prodigy child of the church. And, you know, and I did nothing but, and I loved church. I went to Bible camp and I was a little Christian girl. And until my grandmother passed away at 12, that is when my mother came to get me. Because I had nothing but my grandfather there in the house, and my mother wanted me to be with her. And she came the day of the funeral to pick me up to take me back to San Francisco. So that's at San Francisco. Oh, I was listening to little stuff on the sly, but I wasn't interested in secular music. But once I got to San Francisco, I grew horns and a tail. And I really turned into, you know, the real street kid. I was kind of like a runaway, but I had a mother, you know what I mean? And I had a place to stay.
You know what I'd like to do? I'd like to play one of your rhythm and blues recordings that has a very gospel sound to it. Now, I want to play Something's Got a Hold on Me from 1961. Do you think of this as having a gospel sound?
Matter of fact, it is a gospel song. We wrote that song and we adapted it from a gospel song, and the gospel song was Something's Got a Hold on Me, It Must Be the Lord.
And in your song, it must be love.
It must be love, right, right. Now, don't get me, because I'm not the one who decided to, but I was one of the writers. I just kind of said, okay, well, let's go, rock and roll.
This is Etta James, recorded in 1961.
Oh, sometimes I get a good feeling, yeah.
Yeah,
I get a feeling that I never, 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 never had before. No, no.
Yeah,
I just wanna tell you right now that
ooh,
I believe, I really do believe that something's got a hold on me. Yeah.
That's Etta James, recorded in 1961. She has a new album, which we'll be hearing from a little more later, called Mystery Lady, featuring songs of Billie Holiday. Well, it wasn't too long after you moved in with your mother that you actually went on the road. I mean, Johnny Otis, who had a now famous rhythm and blues touring review, got you into the show. He discovered you. But how did you audition for him? How did you find him, or he find you?
Well, kind of, yeah, I think it was kind of a little bit of both, really. But he really found me because at that time, my mother, I had ran away from home. And I went and I stayed with two girls, one named Abby and Jean, who later became the Peaches. You know, it used to be Etta James and the Peaches. And we had wrote an answer to the song Work With Me, Annie.
The Hank Ballard record.
Right. So during those days, you know, everybody would make an answer. You'd said, Work With Me, Annie. Then we'd said, Roll With Me, Henry. And so one night, the young girl and myself, we were the same age. I think we were both like 16. And the older sister was like 24. And she went out to a dance in the Fillmore District, which was, you know, a heavy drag district of San Francisco. She went to see the Johnny Otis Band. And she was there because we couldn't go and we didn't want to go anyway. We were like, you know, different from her. We weren't like, she was kind of like a groupie kind of a chick.
Mm-hmm.
And we were kind of like scared, you know, to do that. So all of a sudden we got a call that night, and it was Abby calling us back to say, listen, guess who I'm with? I'm with Johnny Otis. And we go, oh, Johnny Otis. And he said, yeah, Johnny Otis. I told him that we have a girl group, and he says he wants to hear us. And I said, yeah, right. how does he want to hear us? We're out there in the project in the boonies, right? And she says, oh, he's at the hotel there and all the band and everything. And myself and the girl, we looked at each other and said, yeah, right. Now we're 15-year-olds and we're going to go to the hotel with the band and Johnny Otis. Johnny Otis was like about a 34, 35-year-old man. So we said, oh, no, that's all right. That's all right. We'll cool that and everything. So Johnny Otis snatched the phone from her. And it was Johnny Otis. You know, we heard that voice, you know. And he said, hi, how you doing? And we said, oh, we're doing all right. He says, I hear you guys got a great group. I hear you got a couple of songs, and I'd like to hear you. And he says, how about catching a cab? I'll pay the cab fare, and I'll meet you out front. And I said, oh, no, now this is getting heavy. This older man is going to, you know, send us in a cab. So we said, okay, let's go on. John, he sounded pretty sincere. And he said, don't worry, nobody's going to bother. He says, okay. So we got up and got dressed, got in the cab, and went down there. Sure enough, as we pulled up, we saw this tall man. You know, we'd all seen pictures of Johnny Otis with the nice hair, and he looked like a tall, kind of like a Creole man with a nice mustache and a beard, and he had, you know, and the nice pompadour hair. And he was standing there all stately, and he had two or three more guys with him. One guy was his manager, was a much older man. And when we got there, he said, oh, I'm glad to see you, and come on up and let's hear you. So we went upstairs to his room and we sang How Deep Is the Ocean and For All We Know and Street of Dreams.
So you auditioned for Johnny Otis. He liked your singing, I suppose,
right,
and invited you to go on the tour, but you were still a minor. Did you have to get your mother's permission?
Well, that was a trick there. My mother, I knew my mother wasn't going to let me go. But I told him, he says, how old are you? I said, 18, which he knew that was a lie. And he says, well, you know what? I would like to take you guys to Los Angeles tomorrow to make a record. And he says, can I speak with your mother? I said, no, I can't find her right now. She's working. And he says, well, can you go home and get permission from your mother, get something in writing stating that you can travel, and give me your mother's address and phone number and all this stuff, and saying that you can travel and you're allowed to travel with me, and have her to sign it and date it. I said, oh, yeah, I can do that. So sure enough, that's what I did. I went home. I wrote the note.
Oh, I see. I see.
And I brought the note back with a tiny little bag, a little plastic bag or something with some clothes in it. And myself and the two girls got on Johnny's bus and we split to L.A.
So why don't we hear the first song that you recorded? And this was the first song you recorded after going on the road with Johnny Otis. And it's Roll With Me Henry, also called Wallflower.
And called Dance With Me Henry.
Called Dance With Me Henry also. And this is Etta James.
Hey, baby, what do I have to do to make you love me too?
You got to roll with me, Henry.
All right, baby.
Roll with me, Henry.
Don't mean maybe.
Roll.
After you recorded this, Georgia Gibbs did a cover recording of this called "Dance with Me, Henry," and
right.
was that supposed to be the tamer version?
Yeah. Well, you know, during those days, you weren't allowed to say "roll," because "roll" was like a vulgar word. You know what I mean? Think about it. They would probably burn Prince at the stake. Right? But you couldn't say "roll." So rather than they banned my record from the air. And what happened, what we had to do was sell it underground, and not only that, change the title to Wallflower. And then when Georgia Gibbs did it, she just made the dance with me, Henry, so that, you know, all the kids could go buy it and, you know, take it home and, you know, listen to it. Because their parents weren't going to go for no roll. Are you kidding? Roll with me? How do you roll with somebody?
My guest is Etta James. She has a new record called Mystery Lady, the songs of Billie Holiday. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer Etta James. At some point in your career, you started dressing in evening gowns for performances and dyeing your hair blonde. Tell me how you created that onstage image for yourself.
I think probably by me being so young, and I was oversized like I am now, but I mean, I had a real nice figure and I was tall. And I remember this singer, Joyce Bryant. She was a black singer, and I always admired her. And I had two role models. I liked Joyce Bryant because she wore fishtail gowns, sequin fishtail gowns, and she was black, and she had the nerve to wear platinum hair. And then I also loved Jane Mansfield, because Jane Mansfield had the blonde hair and had the poochy lips and the mole and all this. So I think what I did was kind of combined. My mother had bleached my hair carrot red at one point, and then I said, well, maybe that's not flamboyant enough. So I just kind of went into Detroit one day, and one of the fellas over there said, oh, Miss James, oh, why, you would probably look fabulous with platinum hair. So he bleached my hair blonde, and it looked good, and So then I started, what I was doing was trying to be a glamour girl, because I had been a tomboy most of the time, and I wanted to look grown. You know, I wanted to wear tall, high heel shoes and fishtail gowns and big long rhinestone earrings, you know.
So how long did you dye your hair?
For how long?
Yeah.
I think, well, most of my career, it was platinum blonde all the way, I would think, up into the 70s, maybe the 72 and 73, something like that.
And why'd you stop?
Well, I think things had changed. I know things had changed, and my career wasn't happening. And I didn't think that I needed to be that, you know, that to attract that much attention. Another thing, I was on drugs at that time, and I think I really wanted a low profile.
Was it difficult for you to give up drugs?
Not when I got down to, you know, I'd given it up many a time. You know, mm-hmm. I'd kicked my habits many a time. But when I went in 1974, I gave heroin up. I was on methadone for maybe 3 or 4 years before that. So I had a couple of things to give up.
Was it hard to make a comeback after you stopped using?
No, not really, because when I stopped using, I wasn't the kind that went around and wanted people to pat me on the back about it. It's just that I just picked up the ball and started running with it. The thing was, when I went to this rehabilitation center, I was around nothing but a lot of white kids. And the thing where they were all younger than I was. And I remember on Saturdays, they would play all these great rock and roll records. The thing was, I was doing R&B, remember. But the ZZ Tops and the Rod Stewarts and the Rolling Stones and all those people, I was busy using drugs. I wasn't there when Woodstock. I was there in New York when Woodstock was going on, but I didn't want to go to Woodstock. I would rather go to Harlem, you know. And when I was in the program on Saturdays, we'd be cleaning up. They would be playing songs from all these people. And I would say, "Ooh, man, that music is really happening." And then what really made me think it is because my song, "I'd Rather Go Blind," they had a version of it by Rod Stewart. And they kept saying, "Hey, this is the song you wrote. Listen." And I said, "All right." And then while I was in that program, they would take me out kind of with support to kind of do little gigs here and there. We went to Africa to do the Black Festival there when Muhammad Ali and George Foreman were supposed to fight. We went to the American Song Festival. And so my therapist, psychologist, was taking me around trying to just, dip me in a little bit, mm-hmm. to let me know, this is the business here that you've been in all your life. Now, what's going to be different about this when you come out? What are you going to do different? Because you're going to get thrown right back in there. So we would just do test runs and things.
In 1978, you opened in some cities for the Rolling Stones on their tour. Were the Stones fans of yours?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Matter of fact, when I was in rehab at the same rehab center in the 70s, 74 and 75, I got a letter from Keith Richards that had said to me that they were getting ready to do a tour. You know, they had Tina Turner and they had B.B. King and they had different people on their tour. And they had wanted me on their tour. And the letter that they wrote came to the rehabilitation center, and the therapist got the letter, and he called me to his office and read the letter, and the letter said that he said, "We would like to have you on tour with us. We love your music." And he says, "But what you're doing right now is more important than what we could ever do with you, but we'll be sure to come back and get you when you're ready." And that was really cool. That was when they came back in 78 and kept their word.
I'd like to close our interview with another selection from your new album of songs that were recorded by Billie Holiday. I thought we could play "How Deep Is the Ocean," since this is one of the songs you sang many years ago when you auditioned for Johnny Otis. What do you think is the difference between what the song means to you now and what it meant to you then, and how you sing it now and how you sung it then?
I think probably it's because now I really understand, you know what I mean? I understand what I'm singing about. You know, songs that I get, any song that I decide to sing or a song that someone sends to me or recommends, I like to be able to relate to that song, not just, have a song there that talks about "Come fly me to the moon, let me dangle on the stars." That's not my cup of tea. That's not real. I want to sing real stuff. I want to know what I'm singing about, and I want to be able to really relate to that, and I think that's what I can do now. I think that's what I definitely do. Matter of fact, I know I do.
Etta James, it's been a pleasure. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Etta James' new album is called "Mystery Lady, the Songs of Billie Holiday." I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
How much do I love you? I'll tell you no lie. How deep is the ocean? How high is the sky? How many times a day do I think of you? How many roses are sprinkled with dew? Ooh, how far would I travel to be where you are? How far is the journey from here to
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Confessions of a Motown Diva. We meet Martha Reeves of Martha and the Vandellas. Their hits included Dancing in the Streets, Jimmy Mack, and this record, Heat Wave. Martha Reeves coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Clinton administration is taking all Cuban refugees who flee their homeland to the U.S. naval base in Cuba at Guantanamo Bay. But an administration official says the United States won't open talks with Cuba about the wave of refugees. UPI's Bill Small reports.
The U.S. blames the record flow of Cuban refugees on conditions in Cuba and the actions of the Cuban government. But is the United States willing to undertake high-level talks with Fidel Castro to resolve the issue? Undersecretary of State Peter Tarnoff says no.
We see nothing to be gained from the kind of talks you're referring to, because it should be clear after 35 years to Fidel Castro and his government that the way he has been managing the affairs of the island is a failure.
The U.S. continues to urge Cubans to stay home, saying refugees will be placed in detention in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, or safe havens in other countries, and will not be allowed to come to the United States. Bill Small at the White House.
The Defense Department says it's pulling all U.S. soldiers out of Zaire. They had been there to help Rwandan refugees. A spokesman for the U.S. military headquarters in Europe says the mission was to stabilize the situation and then hand over relief efforts to the United Nations. The unofficial military newspaper Stars and Stripes says the last American soldier will depart tomorrow. The first serviceman arrived in Goma on July 22nd. A Georgia high school teacher is going to court today in an effort to keep his job. The American government teacher was suspended for not observing a Georgia law requiring 1 minute of silence in public schools. Bruce Dorton of Peach State Public Radio reports.
Brian Baum has taught in the suburban Atlanta town of Snellville for 5 years. On Monday, and then again on Tuesday, Baum refused to observe a state-mandated moment of silence at the beginning of the school day. Opponents of the moment of silence charge it's a veiled attempt to bring prayer back into schools. Bound, on the other hand, says the moment of silence is something he doesn't believe in and should not be forced to do. School administrators have suspended him with pay pending a hearing. Bound has decided not to wait for a hearing and is taking his case to court to challenge the constitutionality of the law. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Dorton in Atlanta.
Senate Republicans are reviewing their crime bill strategy. Republican Senator Phil Graham told NBC today the GOP wants to put strong provisions back in the bill and take out the pork. But Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein, appearing on the same program, says the GOP effort is nothing but a ploy to block the bill's passage. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell says he doesn't know if he has enough support to stop the GOP plan. Other officials say the fate of the crime bill could be determined by a handful of Republican moderates. The government says orders for durable goods fell 4.2% in July, the biggest drop in 2.5 years. On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher. The Dow gained nearly 80 points to close at 3,846. This is NPR. Alabama students have returned to class at a Wadawi high school today. It was the focus of racial controversy. The school was burned a couple of weeks ago by an arsonist, and students are now attending class in trailers. Alabama school superintendent says it may be 2 years before the school is rebuilt, but the town seems to be pulling together. The school's principal made headlines earlier this year when he threatened to cancel the prom if interracial couples attended. He's been reassigned. Russian security officials have announced the arrest of 2 men caught trying to smuggle radioactive material out of one of the country's most important nuclear weapons plants. The BBC's Kevin Connolly reports from Moscow.
This attempted theft of nuclear material from one of Russia's most secret and most important defense installations may become the focus of world attention, but seems to have been a badly thought out and badly executed operation. Intelligence officials say 2 men were arrested with 10 kilograms of uranium-238 at the weekend. the material is worth only around $200 a ton, is available on the open market, and can't be used directly as a component in nuclear warheads. The Russian government has been angered by recent Western criticism of security and safety standards in its nuclear industry after a series of smuggling operations to Germany were exposed. It clearly hopes news of a Russian success in the same area will be interpreted in the West as a sign that its nuclear power stations, and more importantly the former Soviet nuclear arsenal, are safe.
Kevin Connolly reporting. Several religious and anti-abortion activists are saying overpopulation is a myth. Christian, Muslim, and anti-abortion organizers have formed the Ad Hoc Coalition for Cairo. They're criticizing the United States for backing a UN population conference set for Egypt next month. A preliminary UN report advocates controlling world growth by educating women in developing countries about birth control. The coalition disagrees. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Motown Records in the 1960s created a sound that combined soul music with polished production. There was a Motown look, too, stylish choreography, sophisticated clothes. Several Motown artists have written memoirs about what happened behind the scenes of the celebrated Detroit record company. In fact, the founder of the company, Berry Gordy, has a memoir that's about to be published. My guest, Martha Reeves, has just completed her autobiography. Martha and the Vandellas hits included Dancing in the Streets, Heat Wave, Jimmy Mack, and Quicksand. This song, Come and Get These Memories, was their first hit.
Here's your old friendship ring.
Now, this song was written by Holland Dozier and Holland, and really most of your hits were written by that songwriting team. Did you get along especially well? Did you especially like the songs they wrote for you?
I love them. They were great writers, and they were also very good-looking men. As a matter of fact, on our Come and Get These Memories, they made me so nervous. I asked if they would turn the lights off and start the machine and leave the studio so that I wouldn't see them, so that I could sing Love Makes You Do Foolish Things.
Now, you had to go to the so-called Motown finishing school, right?
We all were nurtured at Motown. Berry was very ingenious to hire some very affluent people to train us. Mrs. Powell came from Chicago, and she was one of the top model instructors in Detroit.
This was Maxine Powell.
Maxine Powell. She'd also trained Gwen Gordy, Anna Gordy, Esther Edwards, Berry's older sisters, and she was also responsible for some of the top models of Detroit and their success.
So she was the person who taught etiquette and poise and all of that. And she was really trying to teach the groups how to be very sophisticated. I was wondering if you ever wanted to be more raw and streetwise than she was comfortable with, more like some of the more Southern soul singers, or more like the Ronettes or the Shangri-Las, who had a more street kind of image.
I'm very proud to be a part of the Motown sound, and I've heard that the Motown artists all have a certain rapport, and I think it's basically because she tutored not only the women, but the men, and taught us how to be respectful. She gave us tips on how to establish class, poise, finesse, things that are necessary when you're traveling all over the world and dealing with a variety of people. I've never wanted to be anything but a part of the Motown sound.
I was reading an interview that Maxine Powell had done for People magazine, and she said some of the advice that she used to give the Motown recording artists was, you never turn your back on the audience, you never let your buttocks protrude. Do you remember that advice?
I remember her saying that we weren't the most beautiful women in the world, and we certainly weren't the most talented women in the world, but with what she could teach us, we could go all over the world. She would teach us poise and class that would take us before queens and kings, and we'd never feel as if we didn't know how to handle ourselves properly. Yes, she would make comments about making faces on stage. She made comments about having your buttocks protrude, but no one wants to really sit and watch a show and see that.
Now, the first big Motown tour helped launch your career and the careers of a lot of the other Motown performers. It was a 3-month-long tour. What year was this?
1962.
And before you went on tour, you got your warnings from Berry Gordy about how to behave. There was a chaperone who accompanied you.
We had two chaperones and one man for the men. Thomas Beams Bowles, whose idea the Motown Review was also there to watch and make sure that we did what we were told.
What were you warned about in terms of behavior?
Well, the first thing he did was make a joke about the Contours being dirty old guys and to watch out for them. And they were the least of the ones to worry about. They were very friendly and very helpful. We learned to get along with all the acts, and we grew as a group. We were a big family, and we looked out for one another. We learned to share sardines and popcorn together as a meal.
Salty.
We learned to eat hot we learned to eat hot dogs that were cold and hot chocolate that was cold at the back door of establishments together. We learned how to hold our water because some people wouldn't let us off the bus to use their restrooms because of our color and thinking that we were Martin Luther King's freedom riders and came to cause trouble as opposed to come and make merriment.
How was the Motown bus confused with the freedom riders?
Because we were all black people.
Your bus was shot at, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. The bus was shot at, and it is just as Marvin and Mary Wells, who were singing together at the time, walked past the front of it. I fell on the floor, and Mary laughed. She said, "Look at Martha. She's so silly. Those were only firecrackers." And the next day, when the bus driver dug 3 bullets out of the sign that said Motown Review, I had the last laugh.
My guest is Martha Reeves, and she has a new memoir called Dancing in the Streets. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Martha Reeves, who recorded a lot of hits for Motown Records. You toured during the summer where there was a lot of riots in the North. And in fact, you were performing in Detroit when you had to announce on mic that the city was burning down and people should go home. Do you remember what you were singing, what you said, and how you chose your words?
I was so excited at the Fox Theater to sing Jimmy Mac because that was our next release, our newest song. Just before I was about to sing it, I was summoned from the wings to, come here. And I went over to see what it was and was told, you've got to tell a theater full of enthusiastic fans that the city was under arrest. There was a curfew and everybody had to get home and half of it was burning. I don't know what I said, but I did deliver it without having a panic arise. There was no one running from that theater. Everybody literally walked out calmly, and we all got home eventually to our loved ones and homes as the city burned. There were frightening times, and I was thankful when Dancing in the Street came out because it sort of helped get everybody back together in that right frame of mind to party together and forget about all the unrest. It settled things, and everybody finally got it out of their system. The riots did a lot of good. With all the damage, I hope you can understand what I'm saying. It let a lot of people's anger out. And after everything calmed down, we saw that all we did was hurt each other and tear up some property. And we've got to live down here together no matter what it takes. So we might as well get on with life and just dance in the street and party. Because, hey, baby, we're stuck with one another. Here we are.
Dancing in the Streets is a song about dancing and partying in the streets. Some people really saw it as a song that was associated with the riots, that was almost like a call to riot.
It was after the riots.
The song?
Yes.
Yeah. So what do you make
of
people who saw that
association? That's one of the reasons why I wrote my book. I have to set the record straight. Mm-hmm. I've been accused of being some kind of leader. I wish my followers would get with me because I'm out here on my own.
I'd like you to tell us how you first recorded Dancing in the Streets.
My song... Dancing in the Street was not mine in the beginning. Marvin Gaye wrote it, along with William Stevenson and Ivy Hunter. Marvin had sang it similar, like, sort of like, calling out around the world, are you ready for a brand new beat, baby? That's sort of his style, right? Well, it didn't fit me. It wasn't in the right key for me. And I said, well, I really like the idea of dancing in the street. But then when I thought about it, I had been to Rio de Janeiro. I had been to New Orleans. I saw people dancing freely in the street and having a real good time. So I said, yeah, I can sing it, but let me sing it my way. The first take, they were amazed. The second take was the one we kept.
Let's hear it. This is Martha Reeves dancing in the streets. When you were at Motown, what did you think of as being the look and the sound of your group, Martha and the Vandellas, and how that compared to, say, the other girl groups at Motown?
I first have to explain that I'm a country bumpkin. I came from Eufaula, Alabama. I knew nothing about the city or the styles of the city, and I always thought that something glimmering that fit a neat little body like the one I used to have. I'm a little heavy now, but I used to have the tiniest of waist and the cutest hips, and I have bow legs, and I thought I looked good in a lot of the things that I wore. I didn't know about the look or image. That wasn't important to me. What was important to me was singing, and singing songs from my soul that touched other people. That's where my emphasis was.
Were a lot of the other women at Motown not from the country like you were?
None of them were.
None of them were.
The Vandellas were born and raised in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
The Supremes were born and raised in Detroit. The Marvelettes were born and raised in Inkster.
So did you feel real different from them?
I felt different from everyone in the city. Not just the singers, everybody. I felt really out of place in the city. I went south every summer until my grandparents died.
Now, how do you think that difference showed up in your voice?
I had a real thick southern accent until I went to Lee Strasberg's Theater Institute. I got rid of that because people laughed at me. And I tell them I was from Eufaula, and it even happened today. Somebody said, you what? This is so far and so remote. But I soon adjusted, and now I'm proud. I've been inducted into the Alabama Music Hall of Fame. I've gotten the Governor's Award, so I'm proud now, and I've reclaimed my birthplace, and I'm glad to have been raised in Detroit. And I feel I'm a part of the world, not just the South or the North or East or West, because our music is all over the world.
Martha Reeves is my guest. She's written an autobiography called Dancing in the Street. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's new in Cuba?
Hi, Terry. The number of Cuban refugees to be housed temporarily at Guantanamo Bay continues to rise. 3,000 Cubans are now at Guantanamo, 7,000 more expected to arrive today. They're talking about 40,000 refugees in all, including Cubans and Haitians there. Tom Gelton reports on the changing U.S. policy toward the refugees from Cuba. And I'll talk with one of the founders of the group Brothers to the Rescue. They've been flying off the coast of Florida, helping spot refugees on the rafts. They believe that many Cubans are dying at sea. Ina Jaffe reports on California's economy post-recession, and also a few thoughts about iceberg lettuce. Where would we be without it?
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is Martha Reeves, the lead singer of the Motown group Martha and the Vandellas. Who did you think of as your allies and competitors at Motown?
I never felt that I had allies or competitors. When we first started, we started out together. We all needed each other to become. The Miracles had a hit record, the Marvelettes had a hit record, and so did Mary Wells. But it took all of us together on a Motown review to set Motown where it became, to establish it as a company making its own music. And it was all headed by Berry Gordy Jr., so it's his dream, and he gets all the credit.
I think you came to feel that Berry Gordy started to show favoritism toward Diana Ross, sometimes at your expense.
I know he did, and not just my expense, but every artist at the company. Berry spent the best years of his young life nurturing and developing talent. He started off with Jackie Wilson, and no one can deny the fact that he was one of the greatest performers in the world. He later on had Barrett Strong sing Money, which went to number one. There was Marv Johnson, who went to number one with You've Got What It Takes. Then Mary Wells hit the charts with Bye Bye Baby. He was making artist after artist, and each artist had to have his direct input. He would come to our shows. He would spend time with us at rehearsal. He hired all the people that trained us. He taught us everything that we know. If he didn't teach it, he was responsible for us getting involved with the teachers that we were exposed to. And I'm just a product of good teachers, and I feel good about that.
Let me get back to Diana Ross. Why did you start to feel that she was his favorite and that was hurting
you? Well, if
you.
The baby that they have is not proof enough that she was his pet and special to him, then I guess I should have to say that they formed a relationship that took the business out and I guess made the personal more obvious.
Were you hurt by that?
Oh, yes. Everybody at the company was, even the men who didn't ever think that Berry would be with him. But I didn't love Berry as a husband or boyfriend because I knew his wife. I had been at her recording company and sang a bit back up for J.J. Barnes on the Thelma label prior to coming to Motown Records. So I regarded him in another way. He had always belonged to the lot of us. And all of a sudden, he's a supreme.
You had the reputation for being one of the first or the first outspoken Motown artist about royalties and where the money was going. What led you to speak out about money?
The lack of it.
Did you feel you there was money coming to you that you didn't
have? We were
have?
Selling millions of records, and I had read or deciphered my contract wrong. I thought I was getting a third of a dollar.
What were you getting?
I was getting a third of a penny.
Oh. This isn't royalties you're talking about?
I'm talking royalties. And that's what was promised me, and that was what was on the contract that I signed. And I had no idea of show business. I had never known anyone in the business. I had never seen a contract in my life until I typed our names on the one that we signed. So it was all a disillusionment.
How did bringing up money and the fact that you felt you were being shortchanged affect your stay at Motown?
Well, I felt a certain alienation, and there are a lot of things that I've seen happen where we have not been ignored but just left out of over the years. And I know it's not because of our ability, because I think we hold our own as far as talent is concerned.
How did you leave Motown?
I didn't leave Motown. Motown left me. I was having a baby, and that took me out of society for a minute. Pregnancies will do that. And I wasn't there to hear about the move. I was at home nurturing.
They moved to Los Angeles from Detroit?
Yes, they did, to make movies. It was a move that was necessary because they had outgrown Detroit, in essence.
So you were pregnant, and you didn't hear about the move?
No.
And then what happened?
Well, when my baby was born, I wanted to get back into the swing of things. And 2 weeks after he was born, I recorded a song called In and Out of My Life, which was released soon after. And trying to get some response or the continuation of my career, I called and was always told that Mr. Gordy was not available. And I insisted one day to speak to him. Where was he, and could I reach him at another number? And I was informed by the secretary, well, girl, don't you know the company's moved to Los Angeles? When we move these computers out of here, we'll all be moved. And I had to catch up with my life then and go on.
How'd you feel about that?
Well, it was temporary, a temporary backset. You know, but I went straight from there to MCA Records, recorded with Richard Perry, and had a very good album on MCA label.
Was it hard for you to establish yourself outside of Motown?
Yes, definitely. There's a Motown sound that we're synonymous for and we're famous for, and people expect that from you. If you're not on Motown, jocks won't even play your music.
Now, do you still live in Detroit?
I live in Detroit downtown. In fact, I'm one of very few of the Motown artists who yet remain in Detroit.
It's funny because you're one of the few Motown artists who wasn't from Detroit.
I mean, right.
You were from the South, but you stayed in Detroit.
My family brought me there, and my family's still there, so I belong there.
So it still feels like your city.
I belong there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I want to close with another record of yours, with Nowhere to Run.
All right.
Say something about recording this.
I love Nowhere to Run for two or three reasons, more now than ever, because I talked to a lot of guys who spent their time in the Korean and Vietnam Wars. And they said when it was time for the supplies to come in, they'd line up and fight over the Motown records. And when Robin Williams in Good Morning Vietnam called our name out real loud, I had the biggest thrill because my son had taken me to the movie and said, "Mom, don't jump out of the seat when you hear a certain thing." And it was a big thrill to hear Nowhere to Run.
Martha Reeves' new autobiography is called Dancing in the Street. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The UN is about to hold a conference on family planning. On the next Fresh Air, we meet the U.S. representative, Adrienne Germain. She says most discussions of the issue are stuck in the 1950s. Now, she says, it's time to talk about population control in the context of safe abortion, sexually transmitted diseases, and men's responsibility for children. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.